Good afternoon, I'm Allison Bektesh, and this is Aspen Public Radio, our special broadcast from the McCloskey Speaker Series at the Aspen Institute, broadcasting from the Greenwald Pavilion here in Aspen, Colorado. This hour, we are airing a live broadcast of former President Jimmy Carter and former First Lady Rosalynn Carter in conversation with Aspen Institute President and CEO Walter Isaacson. In 2002, President Carter was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in international conflict resolution, human rights, and economic and social development. Both the former president and his wife are founders and trustees of the Carter Center, a nonprofit organization dedicated to the alleviation of human suffering through programs focusing on peace and health. Rosalynn Carter serves as a chairperson of the center's mental health task force and as a president of the board of directors for the Rosalynn Carter Institute for Caregiving. Support for the McCloskey Speaker Series broadcasts comes from Penny Evans Caruth, with Aspen Snowmass Sotheby's opening doors for buyers and sellers in the Roaring Fork Valley. Learn more at 379-9133. This hour's talk will begin in just a few minutes.
When I told President Carter that we had an overflow crowd, he said they all came for Rosalynn. So thank you, Mrs. Carter, for being here as well. President of the United States and Mrs. Carter, welcome back. Welcome back to Aspen. I'll start by a quick story because Kathy and I are actually here at the Aspen Institute because of President and Mrs. Carter, which was in 2002, right when you won, after you won the Nobel Prize, you were the honoree at an Aspen Institute dinner in New York. And Kathy told me one day, oh, I accepted that dinner. And I'm thinking, oh no, a black tie dinner, I'm gonna be coming back from Atlanta. She said, well, Judy Woodruff called and said President Carter's gonna be there. I said, great. And so then it was at that dinner that they recruited me to come work at the Aspen Institute. And you were so impressive, I decided, yeah, well, that's cool.
Well, if he's not doing a good job, it's my fault.
Believe it or not, President Carter is now 90. And this book is called Reflections at 90. Now, not only does he not look 90, but we were just talking about what he's been doing. He said, well, I used to fish the frying pan. And he said, but I went to Russia last year to go fishing off of Murmansk this year. Right. Yeah. And so a pretty active life, both of you have. And I wanted to start, if I may, President Carter, by looking at some of the travels you've done recently in this wonderful book and talking about your trip to the Middle East that you just came back from. Where did you go?
Well, a couple of months ago, I went to Russia first, and we met with Gorbachev and met with Yaroslav, who is the foreign minister, and then also met with Putin for about 3 hours, and I asked him questions, and he responded. I might say he made a very good impression on us. He was fairly aware of all the difficult issues. He never turned to his foreign minister for any answers. He gave the answers himself. He was quite relaxed. He had a good sense of humor, which was a surprise to all of us.
And, Vladimir Putin had a sense of humor? Give me an example.
Well, when we were getting ready to leave, he said, by the way, be sure to tell your president and the Europeans to leave the sanctions on Russia. Because we were surprised to hear him say that. But he said, I'm making reforms in agriculture and also in banking and in my relationship with the oligarchs that I couldn't make if the sanctions were not putting pressure on them. So the farmers are now growing a lot more food grains and so forth because they have been importing them from Europe, Western and Eastern Europe. And so now they are trying to reform agriculture, reform the banking system, just to accommodate the... he said, if they could take it off 6 months later, that'll be fine.
Ms. Carter?
Yeah. Well, I was not part of the we. I didn't go. But he was with the elders, if you know what the elders are.
Explain what the elders are. We know, because Richard Branson had been
here. I'll let Jimmy explain.
Okay.
Well, the elders are a group of 11 people. The best way to describe them is has-been politicians. Nelson Mandela was our founder, and his wife is still a member. Kofi Annan, the former Secretary General of the United Nations. I represent the United States in this region. Former Prime Minister of Norway, Gro Brundtland, who is a medical doctor and also was head of WHO for a number of years. Mary Robinson, the former President of Ireland. Martti Ahtisaari, who also won the Nobel Peace Prize. He's the former President of Finland. Zedillo, the former President of Mexico and former President also of Brazil and so forth. So that's the 11 members, and also Lakhdar Brahimi, who was the chief negotiator for the United Nations for about 20 years. And he was also the first one that tried to bring peace to Syria. So he's a very wonderful negotiator. So we meet every 6 months or so and decide where in the world we can be helpful. We go where we wish, we meet with whom we choose, and we tell the truth. We don't have to accommodate voters, and so we can always tell the truth.
But let's get back to the Middle East question. Where did you go in the Middle East on your last trip?
Well, we left Russia, and Gro Brundtland, the former Prime Minister of Norway, and I went to the Middle East. We were going to Gaza because the Carter Center has had full-time office in Jerusalem and in Ramallah, which is in the West Bank, and also in Gaza for the last 25 years. The Carter Center still puts as our top goal in foreign policy to bring peace to Israel and in the process to bring peace to Israel's immediate neighbors. So we still work on that. We've the Carter Center has monitored all three Palestinian elections, and we still work between the Palestinian factions and Israel trying to promote peace.
Let me stop. Do you think Netanyahu wants a two-state solution?
No. I never have thought so. I was in Jerusalem on another visit when Netanyahu made his speech and said he would accept a two-state solution. I didn't believe him then. And everything that he's done has indicated he does not want a two-state. He does not want a Palestinian nation next door to Israel. My belief is that he wants to take over the entire West Bank, except a few little tiny spots that he'll leave for the Palestinians.
So you did the Camp David Accords, which was the last really major peace accord there. What type of solution do you think is possible now?
Well, the Camp David Accords had two different factors in it. One was to bring peace between Israel and Egypt. And that peace agreement, now more than 34 years old, has never been violated. Not a single word has been violated in it. It's still peace between Israel and Egypt. But the other half of the Camp David Accords, and the one on which we worked hardest, was full autonomy, you might say almost independence, for the Palestinians. And that part of it has not been honored. So that's what I hope and always hope that my successors in the White House would attempt to do, and try to bring peace to Israel and its neighbors by working between Israel and the Palestinians. But we've pretty well given up on that since the recent election in Israel with Netanyahu and an even more conservative or right-wing government now than we had before.
Right.
And he's made it plain in recent days that he does not want a two-state solution.
Mm-hmm. You also met with King Salman on this trip. What do you think of America's alliance with the Saudis now, especially when it comes to bombing Yemen? And what did you all talk about, or how did you find out about the bombing of Yemen?
Rose and I were in Saudi Arabia and also in Qatar and other Arab countries in that region. And I went to Saudi Arabia to meet with King Salman, who's a new king, as you know. And we were supposed to meet with the then crown prince and then meet with King Salman. We met with the crown prince, and then when we got through meeting with him, instead of going to Salman's office, we were escorted to our car to go back to our hotel. And about an hour or two later, I got a message from Salman saying he wanted to see me but the next day. And we found out that night that the reason Salman could not meet with me was because he was planning and approving a very unfortunate decision to attack Yemen. And since then, Saudi Arabia has been bombing Yemen, which I think is a serious mistake. But I met with Salman the next day to talk to him about the issues that I had on my schedule.
Mm-hmm. Mrs. Carter, what did you, when you go to a place like Saudi Arabia, what is your role and what do you see your role in advocating for women in places like that?
Well, this time I didn't advocate for women.
But you have before, right?
You did in Dubai.
And yeah. I did not with the king, but I did in Dubai and Qatar and the other places. And I also, we went to 7 or 8 of those countries. And the main thing I worked on was mental health issues. I have fellowships, mental health fellowships for journalists, teaching them how to report on mental health issues accurately and in depth. We've been doing this for 18 years now. And so I wanted to get journalists from Al Jazeera because they cover that whole area, and the stigma there is so bad. I mean, they shut people up and don't let anybody know they have a mentally ill person. But there's a really, really good program in Qatar. And so I did talk to and advocate for women and caregiving and those kinds of things. But not with King Salman. Mm-hmm. When I go with Jimmy like that, I take notes.
Okay.
I get to go in to see the top officials because I take notes. And I wrote down everything he said about why they were attacking.
And she also gives me instructions while I'm...
Yeah, there. That's right. That's actually, I was reading this book, which is a total delight. But part of it, and I'm gonna ask Mrs. Carter about this, it's you say the president writes in there that when you came back from the Navy and you were doing your business work and you know your agricultural work in Georgia, you pretty much made all the decisions for the family. But in 62, when you decided to get into politics, it changed your relationship with Mrs. Carter and she became much more of a partner in making decisions. Is that right?
Well, I didn't
want to. We want to fact check this book. Yeah.
I didn't want to come home from the Navy. My mother was at home, Jimmy's mother was at home, and by then I had become very independent.
Yes.
Because Jimmy was gone all the time in the Navy, and I was taking care of everything.
Yeah.
And so I became a total housewife for a few years. I pouted for about a year. And then Jimmy called me and asked me one day to come down and keep... He was his only employer. I mean, he was the employer. Had no employees except during seasonal when we sold seed and fertilizer, and then in the fall when we bought the produce from the farmers. And so he didn't have anybody to keep to stay at the office while he got out to visit the farmers. So I came down. It got to be a habit. The children, the schoolhouse was right across the street from the highway from our office, and the children would come. They were little boys, would come over in the afternoons after school. But I, pretty soon after the first year or so, or maybe not even that long, I knew more about the business on books than he did. And I could say, shut down the corn mill, we're not making any money on it. But anyway, we just developed this really good partnership that has lasted for a long time.
How long have
you all
been
lasted.
Married?
We will have been married 69 years.
Whoa.
In July.
Uh-huh. Yeah. What's the secret? I'll tell you one secret I learned from this is you wrote a book together once.
Oh, that was the worst experience of my life.
That we almost terminated our marriage.
Yeah. We have totally different writing styles. I'm a night person. He's a morning person to start with. And I like to ride at night. He doesn't like for me to ride at night, but that's not much of the problem. The problem was that trying to remember what we did in the past, there's no possible way. You can remember 95% and we would fight. We got so that we could not mention it without me crying. And so we started writing ugly notes to each other on our word processors. It was a never, and he said that it takes me a long time to write a chapter because I want it to be just right. He can wipe one in an afternoon, and then he wants to swap, so he sees mine and I see his. And he said that I was like, I figured that my chapter was that I had gone up on Mount Sinai and come down with it in concrete words, and I didn't want him to change a word. And it was true.
And she treated all my chapters like a rough draft.
That was true, too. Couldn't do it.
So we decided to give up on the book. And so we had gotten a small advance, and we decided to give the advance back and cancel the book. And our editor came down the plains, and he said, look, you've agreed on about 95% of the book, but these other 5% is what you can't agree. Let me resolve this for you. We said, okay. So he said, these paragraphs, half the paragraphs are Rosalind's. And she can write them. Jimmy, you can't touch them. And the other half of the paragraphs are yours, and Rosalind can't edit them. So if you read our book, by a lot of paragraphs, it's got an R by the side or a J. Peter Osnos was the editor.
Yeah.
Anyway, we survived that, and that's why we're still married today.
That's good. Let me, if I may, take you back to World Affairs for a moment, which is your presidency was when the Iranian Revolution happened. And let's go back there, but then also what's happening with the U.S. and Iran right now. Right after the Iranian Revolution, you kept diplomatic relations, am I correct, with Iran after the revolution. But that's why the hostages, that's who they were our diplomats. Do you think the Ayatollah wanted to have that rupture with the United States, the original Ayatollah?
No, he didn't. I think he was completely surprised when the young students, I'll call them, captured our hostage. They overran the U.S. Embassy. I had about almost 70 ambassadors there, or diplomats, and he had almost the same amount in Washington. And then after the young students were there about 2 or 3 days occupying the embassy, the Ayatollah's son went to the embassy and aligned himself with the students, and then and only then the Ayatollah endorsed the taking of the hostages. But I never have believed that he originated it or was in favor of it.
Do you think we could and should work to have a restored relations with Iran?
Yeah, I do.
Through this deal, nuclear deal?
The elders visit Iran, by the way. We go, as I said, we can go anywhere we want to. But I hope and pray that the present negotiations on the nuclear issue will be successful.
And do you think if that happens, it will bring us back to the period in the 70s where the Iranian people were our strongest allies in the region?
Oh, I don't think strongest, but I think tentative allies on a very cautious,
A
very cautious way. You know, we've got a lot to work on. One of the things, interesting things that Putin said the night we were with him almost to change the subject was he said, I've had two different sessions here in Russia this year, in January and April of this year, with representatives from Syria to try to resolve the Syria issue. And he said, it hasn't been very fruitful, but what I think we should do is to have the United States and Russia sponsor a meeting with the top leaders in the region, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Turkey. And we should get those five leaders together, or their representatives, and we can decide together what to do about Syria. And whatever we decide, Assad and the Syrian opposition will have to agree to it. And I said, well, that's a wonderful idea. Have you made that proposal to President Obama? He said, no, I haven't. And I said, do you mind if I make the proposal to him on your behalf? And he said, please do. So the next day I sent Obama an email and told him that that was what Putin asked me to relate to him. And about a week later, you may remember that John Kerry went to see Putin to discuss that issue with him. I don't know what has happened since then.
What do you think of John Kerry as Secretary of State?
I think he's one of the best Secretaries of State we've ever had. I think he's outstanding.
What about President Obama's success or failures on the world stage? How would you assess that?
On the world stage, I think they've been minimal. I think he's done some good things domestically, like the health programs and so forth. But on the world stage, just to be objective about it as I can't think of many nations in the world where we have a better relationship now than we did when he took over. You know, if you look at Russia, if you look at England, if you look at China, if you look at Egypt and so forth, I'm not saying it's his fault, but we have not improved our relationship with individual countries, and I would say that the United States' influence and prestige and respect in the world is probably lower now than it was 6 or 7 years ago. Let me repeat, I don't blame him for it because it's been circumstances that have evolved. But I think that John Kerry has been a very courageous and innovative and dynamic Secretary of State. As a matter of fact, when President Obama was inaugurated his second term, Rosa and I went up to the inauguration, and John Kerry and his wife came to our hotel room that morning and spent 2 hours before the inauguration ceremony. And John Kerry outlined all the things that he planned to do as Secretary of State. At that time, for instance, President Obama had not even visited Israel. And one of the things that he said that he was going to ask is for Obama to visit Israel, which he did later on. And he tried, I think, his best to bring about a peace agreement in the Middle East and to do other things that I need not mention.
Mm-hmm. And to what extent, though, do you think it is partly Obama's fault that he hasn't been able to establish relationships with other countries?
Well, I think that this may not be a good thing to say to a group of Americans, but I think that the historical trend is for the United States to relinquish its unquestioned domination of the world's politics and economy and cultural influence. I think that the...
Is that a good or a bad thing?
Well, I think it can be a good thing because I believe that the so-called BRIC countries, you know, China is rising, Russia's going to come back, and other countries are also. Brazil is increasing its influence. India is increasing its influence compared to what it was 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I can't say that I could blame President Obama for it. I think it's an inevitability. And now the thing to do for President Obama and the next president is to say, how can the United States fit in and still accomplish our goals of promoting the elements of a superpower? And what are the elements of a superpower? This is maybe preaching a little bit, but I think a superpower not only should be the top country as far as military power is concerned, which we're going to continue to be, but I think the American superpower goal should be to be the champion of peace and to be champion of human rights and to be the champion of the environment and to be the most generous nation on earth. Those are the elements that I hope eventually the United States will set as goals. And we are the most warlike country on earth. We are a laggard in addressing the problem of global warming, for instance, and we are now violating about 10 of the 30 paragraphs in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So, you know, I think this is something we should look upon as opportunities or duties for the future.
You know, the two of you came on this Aspen trip that a lot of us took to the Arctic, and I wanted to turn to Mrs. Carter. about what, you know, your views, how they changed on the environment, that trip to the Arctic, and also maybe just what it's like traveling with President Carter.
Well, I travel with him all the time. We have programs in 80 countries. 80 countries, the poorest, most isolated countries in the world. And but that trip to the Arctic was really special, I thought. We had on that ship, it was, what was it? National Geographic.
Yeah.
It's National Geographic. And we had, everybody on the trip had to be an expert in environment. I had to say something about the environment. And we heard the best people. But Jim has been working on environmental issues since he was governor of Georgia, saving rivers and things like that, marshlands. And so I think he's taught me pretty well a long time ago that we really needed to take care of the environment.
Mm-hmm. President Carter, in this book, which I really do urge people to read, one of the things I didn't quite know, although I did read Hour Before Daylight, which was your childhood book, so I'm sure it's in there too, about growing up in Archery, a tiny unincorporated town, and you were one of only two white families and the only white kids in that town. Explain how your views on race were formed there, and then I'd love to take you to this past week where we've had another great confrontation on race.
Well, you're right about this. I was, there were about 55 African-American families and our family, and I was the only child of that age, and all of my playmates when I grew up were African-American, were black boys, and we played baseball together and fought and wrestled and went fishing and hunting and worked in the field together, and so that was my life. And it was during the time of racial segregation, which lasted 100 years in this country, as you know, from the 1860s till the 1960s. And I was very unaware of the racial distinctions, because we treated each other equally. Whoever was the best wrestler or caught the biggest fish or hit the baseball the best was, best for an hour or two. And I didn't realize at the time that the African-American kids had inferior schools. They had to go to their own schools, their own churches. Black people were not permitted to vote. They were not permitted to serve on a jury and so forth. But my opinion was distorted by the fact that the richest and most influential and respected person in Archery was a black person who was an African Methodist Episcopal bishop, and that was the same denomination as the church in Charleston. And he was a world traveler, and he was in charge of all the AME churches in five northern states. And when Bishop Johnson came home to Archery, it would be front page headlines in the county paper that Bishop Johnson would be visiting his home church in Archery on the weekend. And so he was rich. He had either a black Cadillac or a black Packard all the time. He had a driver. He was a chauffeur. And when he got ready to talk to my father, the custom was that black people didn't come to the front door of a white family. And he wanted to, abide by the mores of it. South, but not to admit that he was inferior in any way. So he would send his chauffeur down to our house to make sure my father was at home, and then he would go back and get Bishop Johnson and drive up in our front yard and blow the horn, and my daddy would go out and talk to Bishop Johnson in the car. So I looked upon him as the most successful and admirable person in my life. But later, I began to see much more clearly about the distinctions. My mother was a registered nurse, and she was immune from criticism because of her treating black people as equals. After my father got a little more affluent, my mother quit nursing in the hospital where she got $4 a day for 12-hour duty, and she nursed in the African-American homes in Archery. And she was supposed to get paid $6 a day for 20-hour duty. So my two sisters and I very seldom saw my mother during those times, because she would come home at night at 10 o'clock, and she would wash our uniforms and take a shower bath and write instructions for us what to do the next day, and she would go back on duty at 2 o'clock in the morning. So she was on duty 20 hours a day. And so she refused to admit in any way that African Americans were not at least equal to white people. And so those kind of experiences really shaped my life for the future, I'd say.
So what happened in Charleston last week involved three of the most controversial issues we have: race, guns, and mental health. I want to get Mrs. Carter to address the mental health issues, but what was your reaction on how people reacted with regard to race and the guns issue?
Well, on the race issue, I think there's no doubt that South Carolina is now going to finally lower their Confederate flag, mm-hmm. which Georgia did about 10, 15, 12 years ago. And the governor that lowered the Confederate battle flag was defeated in the next election by a Republican who was in favor of keeping the flag. And the Republicans have been in the power in the South, in Georgia, ever since. So I think that's one thing that's going to be accomplished. Guns, I don't think the NRA is going to relinquish any of its present, almost disgusting influence over state legislatures or the Congress. So we'll continue to have a plethora of guns quite unnecessarily in the United States. I don't think we're going to have any need for proof of past experience or whether you're qualified to get guns. And I think that the NRA is going to continue to prevail, which I think is a dastardly thing to have happen and a great affliction on this country. I'm an active hunter. I like to hunt and fish in my life, and I've got a number of guns, but I think that anybody that gets a gun ought to be fully qualified and give a background briefing. And I don't believe that we ought to authorize a sale of submachine guns and armor-piercing bullets and guns in churches and guns in schools and that sort of thing. I think it's absolutely ridiculous that we do that, but the NRA prevails.
I get very upset when people with mental illness are blamed for everything that happens like that, because only 4% of all violent crimes are committed by people with mental illnesses. And if you look at the statistics, if you look at their lives, most of them, you will find, have not had access to services. People knew that they needed services, but they didn't. The one in Washington, in the Capitol, I think how many times had he been to try to get help and couldn't get it? Anyway, I hope the stigma is lifting a little bit now. I have a program at the Carter Center. I have a mental health program there. And we have mental health fellowships for journalists. One day we were sitting around, and this was 18 years ago, trying to decide what else we could do to overcome stigma. And somebody said, why don't we bring journalists in and let them know about mental illnesses so they can write accurately and in depth. And my journalists have been doing that for a long time now, and I think it has made a little bit of difference. But I do also think that stigma is beginning to lift a little bit. I've worked on mental health issues for 44 and a half years. I started with stigma. we, with our journalists, had a program in California, an international program on trying to overcome stigma. And now 8 countries, including Australia, 2 European countries, and others, want a program in journalism like that to copy my program, which makes me feel really good. But I do think the time has come, because young people now will go for help more than others. People don't go for help because they don't want to be labeled mentally ill. So anyway, hopefully, that stigma's beginning to lift a little bit.
What can we do to have more access to mental health services, especially for young people, in addition to lifting the stigma?
Well, the largest mental health facilities in our country are the prisons and jails. You can get money for prisons and jails. It's really difficult to get money for mental health services. Mental health has always, ever since I started working on it, has gotten what was left over after everything was funded. The Parity Law is changing that a little bit. I hope it's going to change it a lot. Sometimes it takes a little while for people to begin accessing services because of stigma. But the Parity Law is insurance for mental health illnesses the same as those for any other illnesses. And I, one of my greatest disappointments in my life was passing a Mental Health Systems Act that the next president put on the shelf and didn't implement it. We had parity in insurance. We had integration of services, meaning I think at that time, instead, now we're working on having somebody with a primary, somebody with a mental professional in the office of a primary care professional. And that's really helping too. And the whole country's kind of moving that way. But parity, once people begin accessing services, I think it's going to be a flood doing that. And I had parity, I had integration of services, I had incentives for people to go into the mental health profession. All of that in my bill, what, 30-something years ago?
This is during the presidency period.
Yes.
Because you did work in Georgia, too.
But I did. Yeah. I did. I worked in Georgia. I had the Governor's Commission. And then when Jim was at the White House, I had a President's Commission. And now I have the best program in the country and at the Carter Center.
Thank you for that. Thanks for what you do. One other program you're involved with is what I'll call domestic caregiving, but I'd rather you describe it. Explain how that works.
Well, when we came home from the White House, our local state university had a small endowment for mental health program. Well, by the time I thought I could do something, because I was writing a book and doing lots of things, by the time I thought I could do something else, I already had a good mental health program at the Carter Center. And so we decided to work with those caring for people with mental illnesses, because I had seen so many people. When somebody in the family would develop a mental illness, they had no idea where to go or what to do. And there are lots of services out there in the community. And so before the first conference, though, we had a program on burnout. And we brought in people in the small community. Everybody knows what's going on. And we had people who were caring for frail elderly family members or handicapped children who wanted to come. And we invited them in and let the university students go and sit with with the one they're caring for. It was the most emotional meeting I have ever been to. People crying, and see, this was 87. People crying, saying, "This is the first time I've ever been with anybody who knew how I felt." They were talking to each other. And we knew we had hit on a real problem. And so we began that program, Rosencarter Institute for Caregiving. And it's grown and grown and grown right now. We started working with National Guard in Georgia with veterans coming home. And then when, this was a good while before, Michelle and Jill had that program for veterans. And so I wrote Michelle a letter and said, "You left something out, because these veterans are coming home with mental and physical problems, and somebody has to take care of them." By then, I had seen so many young wives, particularly, who had no idea what to do when someone came home with no limb. It is really sad. And so we hooked into that program, too. And Johnson & Johnson has helped me. We have evidence-based program that we've done for Alzheimer's caregivers. And we've got that in all the AOA districts in Georgia, but in 12 other states, I think. And now this caregiving program for veterans has we copied it after the Alzheimer's, going into the home and working with the families. People who work for veterans have a hard time getting a veteran to admit that he needs help, he or she. But we can go, we don't talk to the veteran, we talk to the family. And it's a lot easier to get in. So a couple of programs I'm proud of.
Well, thank you for that. I'm going to ask President Carter about two more countries, and then we'll open it up, if we may, to questions. But first, China. You went there for the first time, I read, in 1949, right when it was before the, it had become a communist nation. And then you've dealt with them. You've been almost every year, it seems, since then. Is that right? What should we be doing with China? I mean, are we handling it right? We're turning them into a competitor more than a cooperated alliance.
Well, I got interested in China because I did go to there on a submarine. And this was a time when the nationalist Chinese were permitted by the communists just to stay in a few seaports. And that's the ones that we visited. We were working with the nationalists on that occasion. And a few weeks after I left China is when the People's Republic of China was formed on the first day of October 1949, which was my 25th birthday. So I'm 25 years older than the People's Republic of China. And so I've been going back ever since. And when I became president, one of the things that I won't put at the top of my agenda was to normalize diplomatic relations with China, because President Nixon had been to China in 72 and had the Shanghai communique, and he announced that there was only one China, but he didn't say which one. And so we continued under him and President Ford just to recognize Taiwan as the only China. So I wanted to normalize relations, which I did the first day of January 79. And so I've been going to China ever since I got out of the White House almost every year. And I've seen tremendous change taking place in China. They still have some serious human rights problems, but they have made a great deal of progress compared to what it used to be when the communists first took over. For instance, there were no Bibles permitted in China. There was no religion or worship permitted in China when I normalized relations. But Deng Xiaoping asked me what I wanted him to do for me personally, and I said, I want you to let Bibles come back and freedom of religion come back. And he did that, and that's now the law of China, with some restraints. But anyhow, China is now the fastest growing Christian country in the world. So they have made some progress. I think under Xi Jinping, whom I've met five times now, I met him three times before he was leader, under Xi Jinping, he's become the most powerful Chinese leader since Deng Xiaoping. And I think he's very highly committed to a nationalistic point of view. That is, China's got to be preeminent. He sees the long-term trend taking place where China is becoming the leader in politics and in the economy. So I think that what the United States need to do is to make a very firm commitment to find some areas in which China and the United States can cooperate with each other. The last three times I've met with Xi Jinping, I have urged him to form a partnership with the United States in dealing with global warming. Because I think no matter what they decided, if the United States and China would agree on anything that would help prevent climate deterioration, the rest of the world would have to go along. And so they could search for some way and without any diplomatic problems or financial problems or military problems, they could agree on that one thing, which I think would transform the world. And I think it would be a basis for further improvement. So I would just say that particular issue and any others that we can find on which we have agreement to emphasize those instead of the differences that exist between us.
And finally, in this book, I recall, you reminded me that you were in favor of normalizing relations with Cuba, if possible, when you were president. Why did you not do so, and what do you think of what's happening now?
Well, when I became president, I saw that the Cuban policy was unsustainable and erroneous. So I lifted all travel restraints on American citizens. Like, while I was president, any American could visit Cuba if they wanted to. And I worked with Fidel Castro on moving toward full diplomatic relations. And we made very good progress the first 2.5 years. For instance, he released 3,000 political prisoners that he was holding, and about 1,000 of them were permitted to come to the United States. And we established an interest section in the embassy in Havana The last time I was there a few years ago, there were 300 people working in our embassy session. Our ambassador, what used to be an embassy in Havana, and they have almost the same number in Washington. So we got right up to the point of normalizing relations. But Castro went back on his word to me. He sent a large number of troops into Ethiopia to fight alongside the communist dictator Mengistu and also the Russians. And he also continued to try to convince some Latin American countries to adopt his policy. So I wish I could have normalized diplomatic relations with China, and I would have if I could have. But I think what President Obama has announced doing is a very good move, and I hope he'll go through with it. Because the Constitution of the United States gives the President of the United States unilateral right to recognize any government that he wants to. The Congress has nothing to say about it. This is one thing the President can do by himself and one of the only things that I can think of. But if he wanted to, he could say, I recognize the Cuban government. But and I hope that before he goes out of office, he'll be able to do that.
Let me open it up and raise your hand. But as I do, let me single out Bonnie and Tom McCluskey, because this is the first of our McCluskey speaker series. Thank you very much, Bonnie and Tom, and any other McCluskey who is here, for doing that. First hand, I see in the middle there and then the way back there. What do you make of Edward Snowden, the NSA surveillance?
Well, first of all, I think Edward Snowden violated the law, and he violated the customs of the of keeping our secrets secret. But at the same time, I think that his overall impact on the United States has not been a disaster. And I think what he has revealed to the American people needed to be revealed. And I believe that what we are now seeing in the Congress backing off from their unlimited intrusion into the internal affairs of every human being in America is coming to a conclusion, because the Congress has now seen what Snowden said. So I think what he has done has been beneficial to our country in the long run. I don't think he's betrayed anybody that works in security overseas, so far as I know. But he did violate the law, and I think if he comes back home, he would be tried, and that's why he's not coming back. So in balance, I think that what he's done has been helpful to our country instead of damaging to our country.
Yes, sir, right there. You could shout, and the mic will get to you.
Thank you for speaking, President Carter. I just wanted you to maybe address to the audience the projects that you have going on to eliminate parasites in Africa. I think it's one of your best,
the
one of the best
worm.
Thing that's going on right now.
Okay. Well, the Carter Center started out just promoting peace. I was going to have a little Camp David at the Carter Center and let folks that had a civil war, a war between two countries, come to me, and I would negotiate peace agreements or go to their countries and do so. We still do a lot of that. We go to North Korea, and I won't list all the countries where we go to. But the second thing we were going to do is to promote democracy and freedom by orchestrating and helping plan and then monitoring honest elections in the world. We just finished our 100th election in Guyana last month. And the third thing we took up, to my somewhat surprise, was dealing with issues concerning health care that nobody else wants to do. So we address diseases that the World Health Organization calls neglected tropical diseases. And we have five of them that even doctors, medical doctors in the United States wouldn't ever know about. Schistosomiasis, trachoma, dracunculiasis, lymphatic filariasis, and so forth. So these are the diseases we address. We have also at the Carter Center the only international task force on disease eradication in the world. We bring in top leaders from the health field in general, and we analyze constantly every human illness to see which ones might possibly be eliminated from a particular country or region or eradicated from the entire world. And so we are the ones that decide and recommend to the World Health Organization which diseases should be targeted for elimination. And we are working now on guinea worm, one of the most terrible diseases in history. It's in the Bible, by the way. It's a fiery serpent that attacked the Israelites coming out of Egypt in the Old Testament. And if you remember the symbol for medical profession, the staff with a thing wrapped around it, that's a guinea worm. And so we undertook this about 35 years ago to eliminate it or eradicate it from the world. And we found it in 20 countries in East in India and in Africa, in 26,600 villages. We've been in every village that has guinea worm. We found 3.6 million cases of guinea worm, and we taught the people what to do to do away with it. And now, so far this year, I just got a report yesterday, we have 5 cases of guinea worm left in the world. So if we're lucky, we'll soon have guinea worm completely eradicated.
Congratulations. Yeah, sorry, I saw Bill and then, was there any women, by the way? I'm feeling, okay, you get you next.
Yeah. By the way, one thing I might say is this year, the Carter Center will treat 71 million people for these diseases that no longer exist in the developed world, but afflict hundreds of millions of people in Africa primarily. 71 million, that's twice as many as live in California.
And
President.
And most of it's by companies that give us the medicine.
I'm sorry, companies that?
Give us the medicine.
Yeah, like Merck Company and others.
Give you the free medicine to do it, yeah.
President Carter and Ms. Carter, it's great to have you all here in Aspen. It's just terrific that the Aspen Institute was able to bring you. President Carter, when you first ran in 76, early in the campaign, there was a well-known Aspenite who died a few years ago named Hunter Thompson, and he was one of the first journalists to actually say, this man has got a great chance to win the presidency. Could you tell us a little bit about the collegiality that you had with Hunter Thompson?
For those of you who don't know, his great book, Dr. Thompson's great book, Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail, was...
I was governor of Georgia, Senator Kennedy, Ted Kennedy, came down to make the main speech at the University of Georgia Law School. And I was going to make a speech to the alumni in a separate and very small meeting of dinner at lunchtime. And when Kennedy made his speech, I was almost exactly what I was going to say, so I just went in the back room and made some notes in a hurry about the problems with our judicial system in the world, in this country. And I made my speech, and Hunter Thompson was listening to my speech. He was also filling up his iced tea glass with wild turkey whiskey. And after I got through with my speech, he was profoundly affected by it.
The wild turkey or the speech?
The speech.
Okay.
And I'm honest, maybe both. But he finally got a copy of my speech from a University of Georgia president. And from then on, you know, he lived near Aspen. And whenever anybody visited him at his home in near Aspen, he would make them listen to my speech as a ticket to come to his house for entertainment. So when we used to come out here to Crested Butte and to Aspen to ski, Hunter Thompson always came and spent late at night with my sons and daughter. I generally went to bed about 2 o'clock in the morning while he pontificated. So he was a very close friend of mine. I remember one time when I was campaigning, by the way, he insisted to Jody Powell, my press secretary, that he have an interview with me, and Jody turned me down. So Hunter Thompson brought a bunch of stuff out of his room, curtains and that sort of thing, and newspapers, and built a fire in front of Jody's hotel room door. So he had his idiosyncrasies, but he and I were good friends.
And the only time we had little white things flying all around was when he came.
Did he come visit you in Plains? Yeah, no. Well, no, Mrs. Carter, tell us what it's like to host Dr. Thompson.
It was interesting. But he did always complain about all those little white things in my bedroom.
What were they, moths or?
Imagination.
Oh, imagination, I get it. They were hallucinations, I get it. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for the opportunity to ask a question. My question is for the Mrs. Carter. First, I would like to thank you for your service to improve the lives of people around the world. I am very heartfelt when I think of all the humanitarian efforts that you have gone to over the last four decades. I'm also touched and intrigued by the research and outreach provided through the Rosalind Carter Institute. Is there anything else you would like to share about the Institute, about the research, or maybe a specific family story that comes to mind that really touched you?
I think, and this is one of the most interesting things, when we decided to have a program, a mental health program, in a post-conflict country. And so we decided on Liberia because we already had an access to information, trying to help women know what was available to them, and access to justice. We had people all over Liberia anyway. So we found out that they had one psychiatrist in the country. That was all. No other mental health professionals. So we organized a program, helped them, helped the country organize a mental health program, and trained 144. We set out, our goal was 150. We saved 144 before the Ebola crisis. When the Ebola crisis came along, we started working we stopped classes and started working with the families of those who died and the survivors. And we did that all over the country. All of the access to justice, access to information people. And on May the 9th, Ebola was declared Ebola-free by the World Health Organization. So that's one of the things that my mental health program did that I was, and it just seemed a miracle to me that with no mental health workers, and then they had 144 when the Ebola crisis hit. It was really a miracle that we were there to do that.
There's a woman in the way back there, and you got it, shout. I'm trying to get our staffers in physical fit by calling on people in the back for a change.
Lady Rosalind, Mr. President, actually, we would like to ask a favor from you. We just got married with my new husband, with my only husband.
Oh my goodness, you actually are wearing a wedding. Yeah. Heavens.
And you are a really nice and good example for us, how to get together for such a long year. And then that's why we thought, if it is possible, to ask you a favor to sign as a witness our marriage license.
I will leave it up to... there's somebody who works with the president and Mrs. Carter, and maybe if you chat with her afterwards, she could see what could be handled. Let me get the woman here. You're sitting next to her, so you can't complain. And this will be, we'll try to make it quick and get one more afterwards. Yes.
Given what you said about America promoting human rights, how did that affect, or how should it affect, America's alliance with Saudi Arabia?
Well, that's a very difficult question to answer, because I'm particularly interested, which we haven't mentioned this time, about the rights of women. And I've written a book about that, describing all of the abuses of women in the world, which is the most horrible human rights abuse on earth. And Saudi Arabia is one of the chief culprits in mistreating women. It's almost impossible for a woman in Saudi Arabia, even if she graduates from college, to get a job and to hold a job. Women are not permitted to go on the sidewalks or in the stores shopping in Saudi Arabia unless she's accompanied by her husband or another man to protect her, and she has to wear a veil, and women are not permitted to vote in Saudi Arabia or to drive an automobile. So when you have, and I wish the United States was not supporting Saudi Arabia in their bombing of Yemen, by the way, but I know from experience as president that it's very valuable to us to have Saudi Arabia supporting our policies within the Arab world, because there's no doubt that the king of Saudi Arabia, being the protector of the two holy places that all Muslims worship or revere, is a very valuable ally to have. So I think that the United States has to swallow its commitment to human rights in order to have good relations with Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia can help us in many ways concerning stability of the oil market when oil is scarce, and also in dealing with the other Arab countries. It's not a good answer because there's no clear answer to it. But you can't be absolutely pure in saying that human rights has to come above everything, because there are some human rights abusers with whom we have to negotiate and deal. By the way, the Carter Center, we meet quite freely with human rights abusers and with people who are basically outcast in the international world, because they are the ones and only ones who can end the human rights abuses or bring peace to an unnecessary war. So we meet with them in order to try to negotiate peace and to promote human rights.
It's a good question, and there is no simple answer there. There's a young woman there who everybody keeps pointing to, and you get the last question. You had lots of fans who kept saying, pick her.
I have a question for President Carter. So I know you haven't spoken on this yet, but I know that you left your church, and can you please describe what led you to do that?
Okay. Well, for 70 years, I was very active in the Southern Baptist Convention. I was on international boards of directors and things of that kind. But in the year 2000, the Southern Baptist Convention decided at their convention in Florida to depart from what I consider the Holy Scriptures. And they ordained, for instance, that women had to be subservient to their husbands and inferior in the eyes of God. And they also decided that a woman could not be a deacon in the church or pastor or priest in the church or a chaplain in the military forces. And in addition to that, they even went so far as to say that a woman who taught in the Baptist seminaries couldn't teach a class if there was a boy among the students. So because of that obvious discrimination against women, Rosa and I decided to withdraw our allegiance to the Southern Baptist Convention. And now we still belong to a Baptist church, Maranatha Baptist Church in Plains, and all of you, I hope you'll come and visit there sometime. Not the same Sunday, but anyway. I teach Sunday school. I teach Bible lessons every Sunday in our church, including this past Sunday. And we have women deacons. Rosa was the most famous Baptist deacon in the world, perhaps, when she was a deacon. And the chairman of our board of deacons is a woman now. And we've had women pastors as well as men pastors. So our Baptist church demonstrates that women, without question, should be equal in the eyes of God.
Well, that is a beautiful sentiment that ties in everything you've been doing for 90 years. I have one quick little question, which is, you fish the frying pan all the time, but you told me you found a better fishing spot that you even told President Putin about.
Year before last, it seems like last year in June, Rose and I went fishing in the Panoy River west of Murmansk in Russia. We had already fished in the Kamchatka Peninsula on the other side of Russia, which is the eastern part. By the way, when we fished in the Kamchatka Peninsula in Russia, we were closer to New York than we were to Moscow. But anyway, we had a wonderful visit there. And when I got through fishing for Atlantic salmon with my wife in the Panoy River in Russia, I wrote President Putin a letter and told him that he might enjoy going there to fish, but also to continue to protect the stream and not let it be despoiled in any way. We had fished for Atlantic salmon earlier, and we have fished primarily in Canada. And most of you who know, if you go to Norway or to Canada to fish for Atlantic salmon, if you catch two a week, that's really good. During the 5 days we fished in Russia, my wife and I together caught 38 Atlantic salmon. So anybody that's a fisherman here, if you want to get the best fishing of your life, go to Russia and fish in the Panoy River. And I hope that President Putin will protect this river, which is what I ask him to do.
We fly fish, and we catch and release, and we press in the barb on the hook so it won't hurt the fish.
And I think that's a fitting note upon which to end, because I always feel that fly fishing is a metaphor for life. And what you've done has been good stewards of the planet and good servants of humanity, for which we thank you very much. Mrs. Carter, President Carter.
That's former President Jimmy Carter and former First Lady Rosalynn Carter as part of the Aspen Institute's McCloskey Speaker Series. Support for the broadcast comes from Penny Evans Carruth with Aspen Snowmass Sotheby's, opening doors for buyers and sellers in the Roaring Fork Valley. Learn more at 379-9133. Aspen Institute President and CEO Walter Isaacson led the discussion with former President Jimmy Carter and former First Lady Rosalynn Carter from the Greenwald Pavilion here in Aspen, Colorado. The couple discussed international relations, race discrimination, and mental health. This talk will be available on our website this afternoon. That's at aspenpublicradio.org. Support for the McCloskey Speaker Series broadcast come from Penny Evans Carruth with Aspen Snowmass Sotheby's, opening doors for buyers and sellers in the Roaring Fork Valley. Learn more at 379-9133. Thanks for listening. I'm Allison Bechtesh, Aspen Public Radio News.